It's the summer of 1982. There's lots going on in the world as usual. Britain has been at war again, this time with Argentina, fighting over ownership of the Falkland Islands. By the end of July of that year, that conflict has come to an end. A conflict that today we don't often think about. There's still lots of those veterans that fought there are still with us, still fighting their demons of what they saw there, just as their fathers and grandfathers had done in the Great War and the Second World War. There was great joy in June of that year in the UK when Prince Charles and his wife Diana celebrated the birth of their first child. And he was christened William. The president of the US was Ronald Reagan, the former actor. He became the first American president to address a joint session of Parliament. In sport, England drew 0-0 in the Football World Cup with the host Spain, and they're eliminated from the World Cup. In the second round, the manager Ron Greenwood retires as England manager and is succeeded by Bobby Robson. Buckingham Palace, a man called Michael Fagan breaks in and somehow manages to get into the Queen's bedroom. And Geoffrey Prime, a British civil servant at GCHQ, is remanded in custody on charges of spying. And then on the 20th of July, I remember this very well, the Provisional IRA detonated two bombs in central London. They killed eight soldiers, wounded 47 people, and seven horses also died. On the 21st of July, the Royal Navy flagship HMS Hermes returned home to Portsmouth from the Falklands War to a hero's welcome. I was, at that time, just 17, coming up to my 18th birthday, watching all these events unfold around me, wondering what the future would hold. Remember, this is 1982, 38 years after the D-Day landings. And 64 years after the armistice that ended the fighting in the First World War. But in the newspapers, there was a short obituary to a man that was called a soldier's soldier, a general, Sir Richard Gale, who rose from a private, the newspaper article said, to the deputy supreme Allied commander in Europe. The newspaper was telling us that Richard Windy, as he was known as, had died at the age of 86. It says he ended his career succeeding Field Marshal Lord Montgomery in Europe. A hero of both world wars, he pioneered key aspects of modern warfare. He made his reputation in World War II as a commander of the airborne forces. And after joining up as a private, he was commissioned during the First World War and won the Military Cross for action with the Machine Gun Corps. In 1941, he was appointed to raise the 1st British Parachute Brigade, which he went on to command. And as a commander of the 6th Airborne Division, he was the first general to invade France 2 hours before landing from the sea. When his company was bogged down by gunfire, he walked ahead in his red beret and led his men in an attack. He received the DSO and the US Legion of Merit. After service in Palestine and Egypt, and as a director of general military training at the War Office, he became Commander-in-Chief of the British Army of the Rhine from 1952 to 1957, and he was largely responsible for the adoption in 1960 of the idea of a NATO fire brigade force for quick action in emergencies. His nickname was Windy, but that was based purely on his surname. And that was it, that's all it said, in amongst all sorts of other articles in the local and national newspapers. It was almost an afterthought to report on the death of this man that had achieved so much in both world wars. And we often on this podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields, talk about soldiers that bravely lost their lives during the Great War. And that's not the case here with Richard Windy Gale. He served, as that article said, with great distinction in both world wars. His story is often talked about in the Second World War, but I thought what I would do this week would talk about him, and we'll hear from the man himself as well. I managed to find his voice on the Imperial War Museum's website, tucked away there, deep in their archives. We talk about what he went through in World War One, and then we'll look at his incredible achievements in World War Two, and hopefully we'll go some way to ensuring that he's not an afterthought in history. We hear so much about the commanders that succeeded and achieved so much on D-Day and beyond, but rarely do we look back at what they achieved before and after their lives, and that's what I wanted to do this week. But before we do that, I just wanted to mention about a public tour that I'll be guiding to the battlefields of the First World War later this year. A number of people have contacted me recently about doing tours, and I think I mentioned before that I do occasional tours as a guide for Ledger Holidays. And on Monday the 21st of September this year through to Friday the 25th of September, I'll be guiding a tour that Ledger calls All Quiet on the Western Front. It's basically an introductory tour for people that have not been there before. And it will therefore be a four-night tour, and we'll be visiting the main battlefield areas around Ypres and the Somme. We'll go down to Arras and Vimy Ridge. We'll visit the trenches, the preserved trenches in Sanctuary Wood. And we'll also be there, and you'll get a chance, if you wish to take part in the last post ceremony at the Menin Gate. And of course, any trip to the battlefield wouldn't be complete without an emotional visit to the Tietvale Memorial to the Missing, the largest memorial to the missing anywhere in the world. And we'll gaze up at the 72,000 names there. Other highlights are also a stop at Vancouver Corner. We'll examine the first use of gas that we talked about previously in some of the podcasts, and we'll see that fantastic memorial to the Canadians who defended Ypres in 1915 that they call the Brooding Soldier. And then just a few miles from there is the enormous German cemetery at Langemark, and we'll discuss how Germany commemorated their dead from the First World War. And we'll also go to Hoog on the Menin Road. And when we're on the Somme, we'll go south and we'll go to the town of Peronne, which was a feature of the 1918 fighting. And we'll visit a museum there. And of course, visit the Lochnagar mine crater in La Boisselle. And we'll get a chance to walk in some more preserved trenches, and this time at Newfoundland Park, another location that we've talked about so often. And there's much more as well that we'll be doing along the way. As I say, it's a coach tour. There are multiple pickup points throughout the UK, so wherever you live in the UK, we'll be able to collect you. You then go down on your feeder coach from your local collection point to Folkestone Services, and that's where you meet up with me as the tour guide and the rest of the passengers. We then make our way over to the Western Front by ferry, and on that first day, we will arrive in our hotel, which is our base then, for the four nights. And then over the next 3 days, we travel the battlefields, crisscrossing the front line so many times. As we go along on the coach, I'll be telling some of the stories that make these battlefields come to life. And then on the last day, on the Friday, we do the opposite. It's an early start. And we start our journey home once again, travelling this time probably to Calais or Dunkirk, get the ferry back to Dover. You then go back to Folkestone, rejoin your feeder coach, and that takes you back home. So two long days of travelling at the beginning and the end. Lots to do, lots of experiences that we're going to cover during the actual 3 days of guiding. So it'd be great if you could join us on that tour. To get more details, if you simply go onto the Ledger website, ledger.co.uk, and then look for the tour that says All Quiet on the Western Front. That's the name of the tour. There's multiple dates, but you must pick the date that I'll be guiding, which is the 21st of September 2026 through to the 25th. Four nights, 5 day tours, and hope to see you then. So let's go back now to talking about Richard Nelson Gale. And I think I'm going to try and do this more so going forward. Somebody suggested this, that we should look at soldiers that served in the First World War and then went on to achieve great things in later life. So where better to start with someone that achieved great things in both wars. He was born in London on the 25th of July, 1896. His father came from Hull, a town in Yorkshire, but had gone to Australia in search of adventurers. So many people did then, and they still do. And when his father was in Australia, he met Richard's mother, who was half English and half Irish. But they didn't have Richard in Australia. They came back to England for him to be born. But they quickly went back to Australia, and that's where Richard spent the first 8 years of his life. And then 2 years in New Zealand followed. But in 1906, the family came back to England, and this was for the final time. They settled in England. Richard was then educated at Alderman's School. He wasn't very academic. He said in his memoirs in later life, when he reflected on his school days, that he was in the category of could do better if he tried. But he wasn't an avid reader. He said in his own words, he said, "I read anything I could lay my hands on, including Disraeli's Vivian Grey, which stimulated my imagination. I loved and still love the classics." It was always his intention to become an officer in the British Army. But unfortunately, his lack of academic success didn't help his plans. He left school in July 1913, and reluctantly, because he couldn't become an officer at that stage, he embarked on a career in the city. And he said, again in his own words, "I was a bit of a dreamer, building castles in the air, a delight I'd never given up, for they are the only castles one can live in, and perhaps they give an impulse when life becomes dreary and slow." But the dream of a military career for Gary, it wasn't gone, because this is 1913, and as we now know, the First World War was just a year away, and the British Army would be crying out for new, keen and talented officers, just like Richard. So when August 1914 came around, as you can imagine, he was only too delighted to give up the day job, and he joined his local regiment, the London Territorials. But he'd been sitting on his backside in that office in the city, earning a living, and it taken its toll on his fitness. And he was rejected on the grounds of his lack of fitness. Now, as with so many of these people that went on to be great leaders, he wasn't to take no for an answer. He was bitterly disappointed to be denied a chance to join in. And things were made worse when a young lady, who was obviously not aware that he'd tried to join the army, passed him in the street and she pinned a white feather to him. That symbol of cowardice. Maybe it was that, or maybe it was already in him, but it made him even more determined to join the army and to become an officer. And he went to physical training classes after work each week, and this paid dividends. And by the summer of 1915, he was attending the Royal Military College in Sandhurst. And by December of 1915, he'd been commissioned, and as requested, he'd gone into the Worcestershire Regiment. But he complained about it. He didn't like it. He said that the training was only half-hearted in that battalion and it wasn't to his liking. And he was aware of the evolving machine gun weapon. And in March of 1916, he was posted to the Machine Gun Training Centre, which is in Grantham in Lincolnshire in the UK. And before long, he'd been seconded to that newly formed Machine Gun Corps. He was obviously very eager to join in with the war. I don't know how these people could be so eager and enthusiastic when I think back to it. This is the summer of 1916. The Great Push is just coming, as they called it, on the Somme. But they must have been aware of all the casualties coming back from the battles of 1914 and 1915. But still, Gale and his contemporaries wanted to get over there and do their bit, as they called it. And he joined the 164th Machine Gun Company, which was within the famous 55th West Lancashire Division. And they were soon involved in the fighting in the Battle of the Somme, and then in the Ypres salient in the following year. He took part in the highly successful attack on the Messines Ridge on the 7th of June 1917. Thankfully, he managed to avoid the hell of Passchendaele because he was home on leave, and he was diagnosed with illness and spent a short time in hospital. And he was also mentally and physically exhausted, and he was sent on a month's sick leave. but he was back in France on the 1st of January 1918. He was posted this time to the 42nd East Lancashire Division and, as we know, in March of 1918 was to be the great German offensive astride the Somme River. Gale and his men were in the eye of that particular storm. He and his men were almost cut off when German infantry infiltrated all around them during the dark. But silently they managed to withdraw to a second line of defence, where their guns, their machine guns, helped to cut down the German attacks on the following days. The final months of the war, Gale was promoted to captain, and he played his part in the final 100 days advance and also in the breaking of that Hindenburg line. He came out of the Great War unscathed, but there had been some close shaves, and he'd been fortunate to survive. During his first entry to the war on the Somme in 1916, just a few weeks after he arrived on the front line, a German shell had exploded amongst his small party of men. It killed several of them, and it left that young lieutenant, as he was there, uninjured, but splattered with the blood and human remains of his comrades. Just think about that for a moment. A shell explodes right in the middle of you, and you're group of colleagues that you train with for months. Somehow, miraculously, there's not a scratch on you. But then you look round and on your uniform is bits of those mates of yours that you've got to know so well. How on earth can someone mentally recover from something like that, let alone go on and achieve as much as what Richard Windy Gale did? We've all faced problems and disasters and tragedies in our lives, don't we? Surely nothing can compare to something, no experience like that. I suppose that's one of the reasons why we're so fascinated in what these men and women went through in the two world wars. In the podcast, in the last one I did about Albert, we talked about a British soldier experiencing his first corpse, a German dead soldier, and Windy Gale had the same experience as well. He had another close call at Ypres in 1917. A German machine gun gunner opened fire on Gale and his Batman, and was in the process of setting up his firing positions, and a bullet struck his webbing in his equipment. Somehow didn't injure him, but his Batman was wounded by that same burst of fire. And later, when Gale had found another Batman, he was killed by a shell as he was in the process of cooking a meal for his officer. Once again, Gale miraculously escaped, but the shock of seeing these horrendously mutilated remains of his faithful Batman proved too much for him, and he wept, he cried, as he tried to wrap the body of his servant in a blanket. His company commander noted the fragile state that Gale was in. He took him out of the line for a period of rest. Gale wrote in his memoirs about this. He said, "I really think that he saved me from completely going off my rocker." So the end of the war came. Most men were discharged, went back to their civilian lives. There was no way that Gale was going back to sit on his backside in an office in the city. He didn't even want to stay in England, and he went off to India to start with the machine gun corps. But then, no longer required, of course, the machine gun corps was disbanded, and Gale returned to the 3rd Battalion of the Worcestershire Regiment, but they're still out in India. And that battalion was disbanded in 1922, and Gale went into the training school for the machine gun section out in India. And in January of 1928, he returned to the 1st Battalion of the Worcestershires, being posted to their staff college. In 1934, he was appointed as a brigade major. And after 16 years' absence, he returned finally to England, where he was appointed to the 2nd Battalion of the Duke of Cornwall Life Infantry. But he found himself once again, although he was still in the army, of doing a lot of desk jobs, planning and preparing for the imminent war that people realised was coming after the Munich crisis. When war broke out, Gale was keen to return to the field of battle. He described himself as a Whitehall warrior, and holding the rank of Lieutenant Colonel on the 1st of January 1941, he was given command of one of the battalions within the Leicestershire Regiment. But just 9 months later, he left the regular infantry. He was promoted to brigadier and he was transferred to the airborne forces and given the task of raising and commanding the 1st Parachute Brigade. And this is where he was to become so, so famous in history. The Parachute Regiment barely existed at that time, but now the unit was expanded into a brigade of 3 parachute battalions and Gale was its founding commander. With the airborne forces an entirely new idea within the British Army, Gale worked closely with his immediate superior, who was Major General Frederick Browning, the father of the British airborne movement. No doubt Gale was thinking about all the things that he experienced and learned in the Great War 20 years before. He believed that it was vital for junior officers to possess a great deal of tactical initiative. And they weren't short of people volunteering to join the Parachute Regiment. And during the process of selection, he asked them random tactical questions and scenarios, and that meant he could pick only the brightest and the most cunning of men. He was also worried about the potential number of casualties that were to be experienced actually on the parachute jumps themselves. It was standing at 5% during the training exercises. He thought that was too high. And he introduced new jumping techniques and careful detail to the packing of the parachutes, and the casualty rates diminished. In January of 1942, France had now been occupied by the Germans for over 2 years. They were already making plans for the eventual re-entry into Europe. And he was asked to select a company from amongst his battalions to carry out a small-scale landing on the French coast. And he chose the 2nd Battalion C Company, that was commanded by the then Major John Frost, who was to go on to become famous for his exploits at the Arnhem Bridge in September of 1944. And that operation was an attack on a radar station over in France. And that took place on the 27th of February 1942, and it was a complete success. But then he had a bit of a setback. The brigade went off to North Africa at the end of 1942, but Gale wasn't with them. In the spring of that year, he'd been posted back to the War Office. He was back on that seat again in an office, and he wasn't very happy about it. He kept in touch with what was going on in the airborne forces. And then finally, in April of 1943, the War Office ordered the establishment of the 6th Airborne Division, and just a couple of weeks later, on the 3rd of May, he was promoted to Major General and given command of it. There was an enormous challenge he had. He had to raise this new division, have it fully trained in time for the invasion of Europe, which at this time was about a year away. He knew that it would be happening at that stage possibly within 9 months. And one of his first acts that he did was to come up with a motto for the division, and it was simply, "Go to it." He said this motto will be adopted by the 6th Airborne Division, and as such should be remembered by all ranks in action against the enemy, in training and during the day-to-day routine duties. Now, as we know, this was to be an elite division and still is. Today's paras regard themselves as elite. Over the next year, Gale worked exceptionally hard to raise the division to his high levels. Now, he didn't know what the division might be called upon to undertake during the invasion, so they had to train to carry out every conceivable action. He studied other airborne operations during the war, including what the Germans had done when their paratroopers and glider-borne troops had landed in places like Holland and Belgium and Greece. All this planning, all this preparation, all these skills that he was learning, no doubt in the back of his mind would have been the horror that he'd experienced on the Somme and at Ypres and various other engagements a generation before. Rather than me talking, it's always great, I feel, to hear the words that he wrote about what the plans were when he was finally told in February of 1944 of the invasion plan and the role that the 6th Division would play within it. He wrote a book simply called The 6th Airborne in Normandy, and in that he says, I well remember, with mixed feelings, on the 17th of February 1944, I heard of the proposals for the part we were to play in Operation Overlord. Our great moment had arrived. I was now to be told what we'd all been so impatiently wanting to know. All our training, all our endeavours, all our beliefs were at last to be put to the test. We tried to think of every contingency. We, the whole team, had studied, laboured, pondered and deduced. We knew what we could do and what we wanted. We knew just how far the bow would reach. General Boyd Browning outlined the plan in general and then spoke of our role in particular. Of all the contingencies we had envisaged, we had never contemplated anything but a divisional operation. I hope I had the good grace to show not what I really felt. I was, in fact, to place one parachute brigade and one anti-tank battery under the command of one of the sea assault divisions, the 3rd British Infantry Division. I was told that, regrettably, the size of the force had to be limited by the number of aircraft that could be made available for this part of the overall plan. So basically, I think what he means by that, he discovered that his unit would be reduced in numbers because some of them would be involved with the infantry landing on Sword Beach. The preparations and the plans continued. With D-Day imminence, he was summoned to a meeting at St Paul's School in London, a meeting that was attended by other divisional commanders that were to be involved in the Normandy landings in that first wave. And they were addressed by General Montgomery. And he concluded, "We were invading Europe with the object of carrying the offensive war right into the heart of Germany and on relentlessly until Hitler and the German army were once and for all thrashed and beaten. We left that meeting at St Paul's School confident in our leaders, confident in our plan, confident in our allies and confident in ourselves." The 25th of May 1944, a couple of weeks before D-Day, he says the men were told everything, not only the details of what was expected of them, but also the larger plan. They were allowed to discuss amongst themselves their tasks and how they were going to carry them out. It was quite a sight to watch them in groups, talking their problems over, their officers moving amongst them to answer their eager questions. A day or so before we were to take off, I flew around the camps and addressed all the officers and men. They were in great heart, cheerful, expectant and ready for anything. I think back to the early part of memoirs from the First World War, and so many of the soldiers talked about not really knowing what was going on around them. And then later in the war, some of the most successful battles I can think of, like Vimy Ridge, for example, every soldier that went into action there on Easter Monday of 1917 had also been briefed in a similar way. It helped their morale and it made everybody feel part of a team, I suppose, if they knew what their role was and what was expected of them. These were some of the learning points that had been picked up during the First World War and taken into this second conflict. There was a man called Dennis Wheatley who went on to become a novelist. And he was in the RAF serving as a wing commander and had been working on the deception plan for D-Day. And he went down to see Gale and his officers at their base in Berkshire. And Gale expressed fears that once he arrived in France, he wouldn't be able to get hold of treacle, which was his favourite delicacy. So the station commander promptly presented him with a tin of treacle. Gale, by this time, was immensely popular with his men. And it was here that he addressed them. And some of them, of course, it would be the last time they would hear from him. He was going to be with them. He wasn't going to be commanding from the UK or from anywhere else. He was going to be alongside them fighting. He said to them, "As for the op itself, only a bloody fool would think of going where we're going. So that's why I'm going there." A paratrooper that was in the audience that day, he said, "We cheered him to the skies." At the RAF base in Berkshire, a BBC correspondent called Chester Wilmot, he'd been talking to some of the men that were to be on the glider that Gale was going on. One had been a hod carrier on building sites. Another had been a toolmaker down in Kent. And there was also a bricklayer from Edinburgh. But there was also two pre-regular soldiers. One had been a deserter from the Irish Army. One was an Austrian Jewish refugee. Three had been at Dunkirk in 1940, evacuated from the beaches there, or the Mole. One had fought during the North African campaign. And there was one young officer, a lieutenant, who before the war had performed in the chorus line of a West End musical comedy. Gale boarded the Horsa glider that was piloted by a Major Billy Griffiths. It was one of 72 British gliders and a total of 1,100 British and American aircraft that were soon to be in the skies. The pilot I mentioned there, Major Griffiths, Gale said about him, he was an expert glider pilot, though he is, will be known publicly more as a great cricketer and wicketkeeper than a glider pilot. I am by nature superstitious. I was therefore very touched when, as a token or talisman of good fortune, I was given a small Crusader sword. This, I believe, Wing Commander Wheatley had had for years. In the glider we all wore Mae Wests, and taking our places we all fastened ourselves in and waited for the jerk as the tug took the strain on the tow rope. Soon it came and we could feel ourselves hurtling down the smooth tarmac. Then we were airborne and once again we heard the familiar whistle as the air rushed by and we glided higher and higher into the dark night. I suppose all men have different reactions on these occasions. I went to sleep and slept soundly for the best part of an hour. I was woken up by considerable bumping. We'd run into a small local storm in the channel. Griffiths was having a ticklish time and the glider was all over the place. I can't believe what I've just read there. So he knows what he's going into because he's experienced the horrors of the Western Front. He knows that the Germans have got all those weapons with which to shoot down his glider, that they've got panzers and Tiger tanks in Normandy waiting for him to arrive. It's the middle of the night. All sorts of things could go wrong. What does he do? Has a kip. It just shows what a highly skilled, motivated, and fantastic leader. His men that were on that glider with him, they must have felt anxious, and then they look at their leader. He's having a nap. His account continues. He says, "We were flying at about 5,000 feet. And we soon knew the coast was under us, for we were met by a stream of flak." Flak means fire coming from German guns on the ground. "It was weird to see this roaring up in great golden chains past the windows of the glider, some of it being apparently between us and the tug aircraft. I shall never forget the sound as we rushed down in our final steep dive. Then we suddenly flattened out, and soon, with a bump, 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 we landed on an extremely rough stubble field. Over the field we sped, and then with a bang, we hit a low embankment. The forward undercarriage wheel stove up through the floor. The glider spun round on its nose in a small circle. And as one wing hit one of those infernal stakes, we drew to a standstill. We opened the door. Outside, all was quiet. About us now, the other gliders were coming in, crashing and screeching as they applied their brakes. It was a glorious moment." Now, by this time, of course, people that have been to Normandy or know the story will know that the Merville Battery was supposed to have been put out of action. They were German guns that were going to be firing on Sword Beach and also Pegasus Bridge. That should have been taken, but he had no way of knowing whether the plan had been successfully completed. It was, of course, as we know. And then he discovered that both operations had been successful. He says it was just before it was getting light that we heard sounds coming from the side of the road. Difficult at first to interpret. We stopped and we listened. Was it a party of Germans? We kept still and waited. I don't know whether we were relieved, disappointed, or merely amused when we discovered that it was only a horse grazing as unconcerned with the great adventure being enacted around it as it could be. I took the toggle rope from around my waist and, using it as a halter, took the horse along with me. I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do with it, but it made the men laugh and it amused me. The next day, the poor brute was killed by a German mortar bomb and we buried it in the grounds of a chateau. It was daylight by the time we reached Ranville and knocked on the front door of the chateau. The poor people inside had not the remotest idea what it was all about. They were frightened, these people, but very kind. They did not know at the time whether this was just a raid or the real and long-awaited for invasion. Would we just come and then go? Then, when the Germans returned, would they have to pay the price of sheltering us? Whatever their thoughts, they never faltered. The people of Normandy are a great stalwart people, not effusive, but loyal and true to the bone. Now, so far, we've been hearing about Gale from himself in his own words. We've heard a little bit about what other people thought about him, but what about this from Staff Sergeant Ernie Stocker? He was one of the glider pilots, and they're on the ground there. He says, sometime later in the day, walking along the road, which was some 10 feet elevated and right on the skyline, came this 6'4" tall man with no helmet on and a shock of white hair. Walking with him was his corporal bodyguard with a Sten gun, and that's all. It was General Gale, known, of course, right from his school days as Windy. He looked fearless while we were cringing. He said, "Where are the enemy?" to me. It should be remembered that the whole situation was fluid and firing was taking place in all different directions. And I said, "I don't know, sir." And he said, "Come on, Corporal, let's find someone who does know something about this bloody war." And off he went. About 9 a.m. on the 6th of June, was a rather peculiar sight, was seen strolling calmly to the Benneville Bridge from the direction of Ranville. The Benneville Bridge is what we now call Pegasus Bridge. It was him, it was Gale, with two brigadiers, all wearing their red berets, and none of them playing the slightest bit of attention to the shots that were passing them. After exchanging a few words of encouragement with the men that they pass, they continued on to their battalion HQ, where they were briefed on the current situation. Gale said, "Up to this time on the 6th, I had no artillery of my own and no artillery support from the Sea Assault Division, who were quite busy enough fighting their own battle in the area of the beaches and the ground just inland. My only reserve was in Ranville. It consisted of about 60 men of the Independent Parachute Company. To summarise, we were very thin on the ground, but we had done what we set out to do, and we all believe that we could hold what we had gained." And hold it they did. And by evening, the 3rd Division, landing on Sword, had managed to join up with the 6th Airborne. They'd achieved everything that they set out to do, but that wasn't the end of the story. Those ridges around the river and overlooking Sword Beach were so important. One of them was called the Breville Ridge, named after the village that sits on top of it, and there was fierce fighting that took place there over the next few days. And it was here that Gale was awarded the Distinguished Service Order, the DSO. His citation reads, "On the 12th of June 1944, the 12th Battalion Parachute Regiment attacked Breville, supported by artillery fire. Major General Gale went to a vantage point to observe the preliminary artillery concentration. On proceeding to 1st Special Service Brigade HQ, he discovered that some of the guns were falling short into the No. 6 commando area. He proceeded to this area to investigate and joined up with a company of the 12th Paras. He walked forward into Breville over open ground, which at the time was being swept by all types of fire. His presence amongst the forward elements, still wearing his beret, continued with the utmost coolness and calmness, suggesting more an exercise than the middle of a very bloody battle. And it had such an amazing effect on the troops that wounded and attackers alike cheered and attacked with such elan that nothing could resist them. The battalion by this time had lost its CO, and General Gale's presence, without any manner of doubt, contributed largely to the success of the attack. General Gale's complete disregard for his own personal safety, his popularity with the troops, and his cool and calm manner has, on several occasions since the beginning of the campaign, been an inspiration to officers and men alike." As I read that, there's just one thought that goes through my mind. In a battle, in a trench, you really want people like Richard Windy Gale on your side, don't you? You really want him to be your commanding officer. Now, don't for one minute think that that was the end of the battle. The battle for Normandy went on right throughout the summer to the end of August. It was at the end of August that the 6th Airborne Division was finally relieved. Gale wrote these words: "Great was the satisfaction that comes from the completion of a task undertaken. The men felt that they had fought for and gained their bridgehead. They held with guts what they had got by skill, to sweep back and drive before them those very enemy divisions that had sat opposite them, mortaring them, shelling them and sniping them, was a fitting fulfilment of the task that they had been given. Before leaving Normandy, I went to say goodbye to the Commander-in-Chief. I took with me a number of my officers and men on whom he'd pinned the ribbons for the decorations they'd so richly deserved. Then the 6th Airborne Division came home. Right well had the officers and men lived up to their motto, 'Go for it.'" And he's written that, "Go for it," in capital letters. Now, once they got home, they rested, replaced their losses and trained for their next airborne operation. Towards the end of 1944, Gale's superior, Lieutenant General Browning — he was appointed Chief of Staff for the South East Asia Command, and Gale was his obvious successor — took over Browning's post as commander of the 1st British Airborne Corps and deputy commander of the 1st Allied Airborne Army. Therefore had to give up command of the 6th Airborne Division. But he still kept in touch with them, and in March 1945 he had a hand in Operation Varsity, which was an attempt by the 6th Airborne and an American division to secure a bridgehead across the River Rhine and into Germany. And then the war came to an end in May of 1945, and the British Army, major parts of it, started to be disbanded. The 6th Airborne Division, it survived for a few years. But eventually, Gale found himself as a general, but without a posting. On the 1st of January 1946, he was given command of an infantry division that was stationed out in Egypt. And 2 months later, he took that division to Palestine, where hostilities between the Jewish and the Arab populations were starting to gain momentum. As we know, it's still going on today. His division was given responsibility for policing the north of the country. And towards the end of 1947, he was promoted back to Lieutenant General and given command of all British troops in Egypt and the Mediterranean. And in 1949, so now 4 years after the war, at the request of Montgomery, he was made the first Director General of the Military Training at the War Office, and a year later was honoured with a knighthood, became Sir Richard Gale. And during these final years of his military career, he found himself travelling the world. He was invited by his old friend and a former US Airborne Commander, General Ridgway, to visit Korea. And in 1952, he was sent to Germany and placed in command of the British Army of the Rhine, and he held that post for 5 years. And then in the mid-50s, he was an aide to Queen Elizabeth II, and then in 1957, he retired and had no intentions of returning to military life. But this is an old soldier. Old soldiers never die, do they? And in the following year, he was offered the NATO role of Deputy Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, and he couldn't refuse it. He had to take it. And then in 3 years later, he retired for a second time. He published two books that I've quoted from today. One of them he called "With the 6th Airborne Division in Normandy." That was published in 1948. And his autobiography, "Call to Arms," was released in 1968. We started the podcast in July of 1982, reading his obituary. And that's where he died, in Kingston-upon-Thames in Surrey, in the south of London. He was 86 years old when he died. I've been to Normandy many times, guiding for Ledger and private groups. We've touched on the story of Richard Windy Gale many, many times without going into detail. But then I stumbled recently upon his World War I experiences, and that's what made me want to talk about him. But so far, although I've been reading his words, we haven't heard the man's voice himself, and I really struggled to find anything online or on YouTube or anywhere where I could find him actually talking. But eventually I found him talking. And where was he talking? Well, of course, he was in Normandy, decades later on a battlefield tour, and this is what he had to say about his own experiences in his own humble way.
Leave it to you to ask questions and for me to answer them. I think probably that's the best way. But I have been asked one or two questions on the way round, and I think it might be helpful if I make some remarks on them. One of the questions I was asked was, did you make an appreciation before the battle? Did you make an appreciation? Now, in the accepted sense of the word, the short answer is no. And the reason was this. If you spread your map out and look at the vast area over which the tasks that were allotted to us covered, you'll see it would be very difficult to make a plan. What could you say your object was? That is the first thing in making a plan. So I decided to work from the limited objectives that had been given me. One had to make a plan for the capture of the bridges intact. And one had to make a plan for the capture of the battery. One had to make a plan to dominate as far as one could a broad area of country. You had to take the first two, but they were fundamental. And then you had to weld the whole thing into one concerted action. Somebody was asking, somebody said, for instance, that would the sounding of a bugle give the attack away? Nothing really mattered if A, we had secured the battery, and B, we had secured the bridges. It didn't matter how much chat went on the wireless or how many bugles were blown, because you had achieved your object and the Germans knew you were there. So that in making a plan of this type, you had to start from the tasks which had been given to you and then to knit the whole thing together as a cohesive whole. That's the first thing. The thing that I'd like to talk about for a moment is artillery. I had the benefit of a brilliant artillery officer as my CRA. His name was Jack Norris. Jack Norris was unfortunately very seriously wounded on the afternoon of D-Day. So that put him out of the picture. But his work had been done before ever we came over. And he had worked with the Second Army artillery the most detailed plans for the artillery support of the 6th Airborne Division. Now, this wasn't a paper plan. It was a detailed plan. It meant to say that we had the wireless sets and they had the wireless sets to communicate with us. When the 1st Airborne Division landed at Arnhem, it was out of touch with the artillery that could have supported it, because the 1st Airborne Division hadn't the wireless sets to communicate with the gunners who were within range of it. This is not said as a criticism, it's just a statement of fact. Now, what was the result of this? Of course, James Hill didn't get any support up here because the thing was out of range and the area in which he was fighting at the moment wasn't vital. Wasn't vital to me. The area that was vital to me was the area close into the bridges. And that contour that you've talked about so much was of vital importance. And it was when the Germans started attacking down that onto the 12th Parachute Battalion and the 12th Devons, who ultimately went into that area when they were landed, that we were able to bring down the fire of the 3rd Infantry Division with astounding accuracy at a moment's notice. I remember I was standing by a slit trench at Hugh Kindersley's headquarters, and the BMRA was there. And I knew that the Germans were attacking, and attacking heavily, from contour 30 or whatever you call it. I got onto the BMRA and I said, put down defensive fire on this area. I showed him on the map what was wanted. I don't want to exaggerate, but within less than 2 minutes, the shells were whistling overhead, prong on the target. Gentlemen, that's planning. And it's planning in detail. Nothing left to chance. Another point I'd like to make in answer to a question that has been launched at me on the way round. How much of the detail of plan did you make as the divisional commander? And how much of it was left to your subordinate commanders? Let there be no doubt on the divisional level that the responsibility for a plan is the divisional commander. He is the architect of the plan, and he must make it right down to all essential detail. It's not good enough for him to allocate tasks unless he allocates those tasks in language which is clear and unmistakable, and gives orders which his subordinate commanders know have got to be obeyed. So that a commander, in making a plan, will go down to any detail which he considers to be essential to the furtherance of his plan. And then after that, he can leave it to his subordinate commanders to frig about to their heart's content. Plan, who had the widest scope, was Brigadier James Hill, because he had this large area of this ridge that runs down that he showed you, the heart of which was at that Le Mesnil crossroad. The whole of that, none of that detail did I go into at all. I left that entirely to him. The tasks which were allotted to the 7th Battalion on the far side of the river and to Nigel Poet were laid down in detail and laid down by me. The place where he was to put his anti-tank guns were even laid down by me, because he hadn't got many, and it was essential that those anti-tank guns should be sighted where they were most wanted. There may be those among you who would disagree with this, but I don't give a damn. with Richard Gale. Neither would you have got away with it with Monty. Monty was an arch adept at planning. When Monty made a plan, he made it in all the essential detail that he considered was essential to the operation itself. You talk to Horrocks and ask Horrocks, who was commanding the corps that conducted that brilliant battle at Elam Halfa. The man who made that plan was Monty. And the man who made the details of it was Monty. And Jarry could tell him, bloody well, get away and do it. That, I'm quite certain, is the right way to go about it. I've seen the other way, when there's been too much looseness and an unfair responsibility put on the shoulders of a subordinate commander. I don't know, but from what I've read of the operations that are conducted in Northern Ireland today, I should have said that briefing was excellent. All the impression that I get is that every soldier, when he goes out, knows exactly why he's going out and what he's expected to do, and why he's expected to do it. And when you take your soldiers into your confidence like that, I'm talking to the private soldier now, not sergeant, the whole way down, right down to the biggest goof. When you take him right into your confidence, you'll get a reaction, which is astounding. This briefing is of the essence of success.
It's wonderful, isn't it, to be able to hear his voice. That recording, that battlefield tour that he was working on, was in the mid-1970s. So he was late 70s himself, nearly 80 years old, and yet he's still very clear and concise and able to recall the orders that he makes sound so simple. There's no ambiguity at all. And I suppose that was the secret of his success. I also noted how he credited other people and other parts of the army. There was no professional rivalry, no ego. I didn't hear any ego come through in his character. And he also made people laugh, another sign of great leadership. And about halfway through him talking, there was an interruption. I don't know whether you heard it. It wasn't from a human being. It was from a cow. We could hear him mooing. Now, we've spoken a lot about Richard, the soldier, the commanding officer, the hero of both world wars. Well, what about his family life? I'm looking at a marriage certificate in front of me, which tells us that he was married at the parish church of St. Patrick's in Hove, in the county of Sussex, on the 10th of May 1924, when he was 28 years old. He married a lady called Ethel Keane, who was several years older than him. And they were married for 28 years, but I can't find any evidence of any children coming from the marriage. I suppose for a great deal of that time, he was serving abroad. I don't know whether she went with him, but she certainly didn't go to Normandy. But their marriage sadly ended in 1952 when Ethel died. It was just a few days after his 86th birthday that Richard Gale died at home. And he talked so often in his memoirs about that village of Ranville, which was taken and held by his division, by those paratroopers. It was one of the first villages to be taken on D-Day. And it's where today so many of his men are buried, in the Ranville War Cemetery, which is such a central part of any battlefield tour to Normandy. But there's a town hall in Ranville, and there's a plaque there that commemorates him. And on top of that plaque is a fantastic bust showing those distinguished features of Windy Gale, wearing his beret, his binoculars hanging round his neck, looking determined, no doubt towards the direction of attack. And I mentioned that plaque. It says in both English and French, General Sir Richard Gale, 1896 to 1982, commander of the British 6th Airborne Division, which landed by parachute and glider here on the 6th of June 1944 in the van of the Allied invasion to free occupied Europe. Simple words, really. And I think that's the message that I've taken from looking into his story, that he concentrated on simple messages that everybody could understand, breaking down the overall enormous task that he was given into small individual tasks, taking of bridges, knocking out the Merville battery, taking the high ground, fighting off German counterattacks, making sure that everybody understood their individual role. Most of all, being a wonderful human being, right up to the day that he died, who contributed so much, not just to the United Kingdom, but to all of our allies throughout Europe and through the wider world. A man that wasn't content to sit on his backside and let others do it. A man that wanted to lead by example, and he certainly did that. So once again, I'd like to end by thanking you for taking the time and effort to tune in. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please do rate and review it wherever you've downloaded it from. That really does make a difference, and I usually forget to ask people to do that. And I've been thinking all day how to end the podcast. Quite often we finish with the sounding of the last post, but I don't think that's appropriate here. As we've seen, Richard Gale was a man of tremendous character and of humour as well. And I found this song, which I think, well, he wouldn't have heard it. I think it was written long after he died. But I think he'd have enjoyed it. It's simply called Green On. And it tells us about that unique spirit of the men that jump out of planes in parachutes. People like Richard Windy Gale.
Oh, you lads want to join the mob? Just come along with me. Here's some chalky biscuits and a lovely cup of tea. Forget the raft, the Royal Marines or the Navy. We think you're big and tough to be in the airborne infantry. Got off the bus in order shot in 1964. They marched us on a parade ground where me father stood before. Old Drummy Williams, he drilled the squad, it seemed like half a day. I've never seen such a motley crew, and then I heard him say, Green on, we're airborne, we know we are the best. But when you put that berry on, you know you pass the test. We go anywhere, we fight anyone, we're always in the muck. They always send the paras in, cause we don't give a toss. They handed me a rifle and a crab bat for me head. A uniform that didn't fit and plywood for me bed. They woke us up at the break of dawn and marched us round a square. I wish that I was home in bed or anywhere else but there. I tapped across the Breckens with a bourgeon on me back. They marched us up to Penny Fan and then they marched us back. You should have joined a Remy, that's what old Drummy said. You still got 25 miles to go before you go to bed. Green on, we're airborne, we know we are the best. But when you put that berry on, you know you pass the test. We go anywhere, we fight anyone, we're always in the muck. They always send the paras in, cause we don't give a monkeys. It started out in Ringway 60 years ago. All those boys have volunteered for jumping through the hole. Oh, Winnie and Boy Browning, they watched with all their brass, but they were the ones who were jumping out and landing on their arse. Green on, we're airborne, we know we are the best. When you put that berry on, you know you pass the test. We go anywhere, we fight anyone, we're always in the muck. They always send the paras in, cause we don't give a toss. They kicked me out for Albert with a parachute on my back. The PTI said, don't worry lad, if it don't, we'll bring it back. I felt the jolt, me nuts went up, the chute went round and round. At least I didn't mess me pants before I hit the ground. I went for pre-selection with a squad of 25. They handed out the weaklings and the ones that couldn't survive. They handed me berry, then took me by the hand. Oh, welcome to the maroon machine, be proud of that young man. Green on, we're airborne, we know we are the best. But when you put that berry on, you know you pass the test. We go anywhere, we fight anyone, we're always in the muck. They always send the paras in, cause we don't give a monkeys. They sent us into battle, we took it in our stride. A shouting while Muhammad, we all jumped in with pride. The Royal Marines, they stood and watched, they seemed so mystified. Don't worry lads, we'll sort them out, you run away and I. Green on, we're airborne, we know we are the best. Oh, when you put that berry on, you know you passed the test. We go anywhere, we fight anyone, we're always in the muck. They always send the parrots in, cause we don't give a monkeys. They always send the parrots in, cause we don't give a toss. They always send the parrots in, cause we don't give a...